Friday, and a beautiful one at that.
Awesome.
Welcome to the best happy hour that there is. 5 p.m. on Friday, everybody. It's time for American Hit Radio on WHPC 90.3 FM. I'm your host, Tom Ryan. With me, my lovely wife and co-host, Heidi Morales Ryan.
Pilot and co-pilot.
That's right. I will say that for sure right now. I'm telling you, we have been sitting in a car for about maybe something like 16 hours out of the past 24 today.
Good times.
So I just got here just in time for the radio show. I apologize in advance if I sound a little bit disoriented or, you know, I mean, just that much time in a car, it'll get to you. And usually, I mean, I have a little bit of time during the day to prep. It's been a little rough today, but I usually do this the weekend in advance, so I think we'll be fine. Just forgive me in advance just in case, though. This is part 42 today, amazingly. Part 42 in our coverage of the Rolling Stones, their entire history, in our How Music Changed series, which is to say we've been doing this now for pretty much the better, just about a full year. We're getting close to that.
Unbelievable.
Considering that we probably missed a few weeks, I had to repeat a couple here or there. And this brings us up to the time when the Rolling Stones were releasing the album Voodoo Lounge, which was in 1994. So we are suddenly we're moving along in big chunks of time, where the first other shows would maybe we'd spend three shows on 1 year, because from the years 65 until the year 72, the Stones were quite active, and the music they were releasing was very vital. All of a sudden now they're much less active, and it's sad to say, but the music is that's coming out isn't quite as it's you don't feel the need to hear every track for what it's worth,
sadly,
which is sad. Now, what we covered last week we looked at the album Steel Wheels, played a good percentage of that, a good record. It was like the Stones beginning to sound like a band again, which is what we had commented on. That it was followed by a live album. Well, actually, it was preceded by the live album Still Life. That's the first thing. And that was like the setup of this album, live album thing. Mm-hmm. After Steel Wheels came the live album Flashpoint. We had touched on that lightly at the end of our show last week. There are a couple of tracks that I want to play from that album now. Not because they're, you know, mediocre live versions of songs that had been hits. What's interesting about these is that they actually, as a sales tactic, added on two new studio songs at the end of the live album.
Uh-huh, clever.
A new trick. The Stones are very good at being tricky at trying to get people to buy things, and that was a tactic that worked there. They also, the one that really got me was when they released Flashpoint, they released it with a second disc in a bonus version, which had a lot of the 12-inch mixes of a lot of their hits, and I was a Stones completist. I felt like compelled to own everything
That's cheeky.
The band. So I had to buy this CD because it had mixes that I had never heard of before.
You're also mentally ill in that regard, but never mind.
Deeply mentally ill, because that mix CD is really virtually unlistenable parts of it. You know, how many different versions of like Winning Ugly do you need? You know what I mean?
You should have asked yourself before you parted with your money.
Especially then, when I really could have used the money and done something else with it. But the studio tracks are relatively interesting. For what the first one up was actually released as a single. Here is that tune. It's called High Wire.
Talk to the man right away. We walk the highway, send a
It's a bit of a cheeky maneuver, putting a studio track on the live album.
I'll say.
Trying to see if you could attract more sales to do it. It was, as I had mentioned last week, the last top 10 hit single came off of the previous album, Steel Wheels, Mixed Emotions. And then the last top 40 hit for the Stones came off of the same album immediately after that, Rockin' a Hard Place, when it went to number 23. So here we are a couple of years later after that. Highwire came out in March of 91, and it stalled at number 57. Sort of the start of a trend where the Stones were really no longer that relevant on the pop charts. They were still doing fine with their album sales, though. Quite fine. What makes these songs significant historically from a Rolling Stones perspective is that that track and the next one we are going to play happened to be the very last pieces of work that the Stones would record with their bass player, Bill Wyman.
Oh.
Who decided to retire at this point.
Was he ill?
No, not at all. In fact, since you asked, here's how Keith Richards describes the situation and his his book, Life. In any band, you're learning how to play together all the time. You always feel that you're getting tighter and better. It's like a close family. If one person leaves, it's a bereavement. When Bill Wyman left in 1991, I got extremely stroppy. I really did have a go at him. I wasn't very nice. He said he didn't like to fly anymore. He had been driving to every gig because he'd developed a fear of flying.
Oh, boy.
That's not an excuse. Get out of here. I couldn't believe it. I'd been in some of the most ramshackle aircraft in the world with that guy, and he'd never batted an eyelid. But I guess it's something that one can develop. Or maybe he did a computer analysis. He was very into that. Bill had one of the first. It satisfied that meticulous mind of his, I suppose. He probably got something out of the computer, like the odds against you after flying so many miles. I don't know why he's so worried about dying. It's not a matter of avoiding it. It's where and how. But then, what did he do? Having freed himself by luck and talent from the constraints of society, that 1 in 10 million chance, he goes back into it, into the retail trade, putting his energy into opening up a pub. Why would you leave the best band in the world to open a fish and chip shop called Sticky Fingers? Taking one of our titles with him. Seems to be doing well. What's super ironic, though, is that the last song that the Stones recorded with Bill Wyman happened to be called Sex Drive. This is the man who had been, let's see, according to Maxim magazine, the men's magazine, Bill Wyman is ranked at number 10 on its living sex legends of all time.
Interesting.
Basically because he is, as he is reputed to have had sex with over 1,000 women.
Whoa.
In his own autobiography, Bill's, which I
He's
didn't really...
He's rivaling you. Just kidding. Just kidding.
Oh, my.
That was a joke.
Imagine that. I mean, it's just not to mean... What makes it, like, really, you know, really amazingly, besides the fact that he pretty much claimed to have a different woman every single night when he was on tour, sometimes two or three.
Oh, boy.
In 1989, what was interesting is he married 18-year-old Mandy Smith, who he reportedly had been dating since she was 13.
Oh, my goodness.
And when he was 47.
Oh, creepy.
According to Smith, their relationship was consummated when she was 14 years old. And their relationship obviously was the subject of a lot of media attention.
Mm-hmm.
The marriage did end in spring 1991, though the divorce wasn't finalized until a few years later. But what's crazy is that while Wyman was still married to Smith, his son Stephen, who he had from his previous wife, had become engaged to Smith's mother. So we have Bill Wyman marrying the 18-year-old, then Wyman's son, who apparently, I'm not exactly sure of his age, actually he was born in 1962, so he was about 30. He was marrying his dad's wife's mother. It's that whole I'm my own grandpa thing
right.
going on there. Totally insane. Well, that was... the craziness that was Bill Wyman's life around this time.
Oh,
and as I said, only fitting that the last track that he would record with the Stones would have the title Sex Drive.
What the sex drive? Driving
Track is called Sex Drive. If you don't recognize it, it's probably because of the fact that it was buried on the live album Flashpoint as a studio track that was available only there.
Hmm.
I'll let Keith talk a little bit about what caused some of the delay between the long stretch of time between Steel Wheels and their next album, Voodoo Lounge, which, as I said, came out in 1994. Again, reading directly from Keith's book. 4 years went by between Steel Wheels and Voodoo Lounge, which kicked off in 1994. It gave me and everyone else time for other music, for solo records and guest spots, tribute albums, and idol worship of various kinds. Eventually, I played with almost all of the survivors among my childhood heroes, like James Burton, the Everlys, the Crickets, Merle Haggard, John Lee Hooker, and George Jones, with whom I recorded Say It's Not You. The award I was proudest of was when Mick and I were inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame in 1993 because it was signed by Sami Khan on his deathbed.
Wow.
It took me years to appreciate just how great was the art of Tin Pan Alley songwriting. I used to dismiss it, or it went straight through me. But when I became a songwriter, I could appreciate the construction and the skill of all those guys.
Hmm.
I held Hoagy Carmichael in the same high esteem, and I will never forget him calling me 6 months before he died.
Wow, that's intense.
Right, so there's all that. In the meantime, of course, not only that, but I mean, between the two studio albums from the Stones, there was yet another Jagger solo album. There was also a Keith, which was called Wandering Spirit. And Keith Richards released a second album called Main Offender. So there's all of that. Oh, fine. All of that is happening. So finally they get around to actually recording the album Voodoo Lounge and putting it out. The first song off of the album, also the first single from the album, is called Love is Strong. It's stalled. This is amazing for a song that's kicking off an album. This is bizarre for the Rolling Stones. The song stalls at number 91 on the pop charts. Here's Love is Strong.
Someday, babe, we got to meet.
one thing that the chart position of that track made painfully clear is that the times had changed an awful lot in the pop world. Mm. The Stones were no longer really a part of that, even though they had come from it and had helped to develop it and make it what it is. They were now more or less a classic rock band, and people were going to be right. People were perceiving them as such. So the singles were essentially deemed irrelevant, which in some cases was sort of a drag because the songs themselves were pretty good. That song would have done fine. I mean, I'm not saying that it's a classic Stone song in comparison to the stuff that they had put out in the 60s and the 70s, but it might have held its own in another time, but it was more or less out of place in 94. It's a shame for another reason. There were sometimes songs on the B-sides of these singles or a second or third track on the CDs, because that's how these singles were, of course, coming out at this point in time. They weren't vinyl, really. But there was a track here that was a total sleeper that didn't come out on any album. As far as I know, it only was available on the U.S. CD single for the song Love is Strong. And I always liked this tune. So it's got short shrift, so why not play it now? As the alleged, you could call it the B-side of Love is Strong. The track is called The Storm.
I must have been foolish, I must have been blind, I must have been crazy, and out of my mind for so long. Minutes turned to hours, and hours turned into days. Storms started howling, I'm out of my brain. I'm out of my brain for so long.
Me, the funny thing from around this time period of the Stones is that the deep tracks like that was some of the best material that they were making.
Yeah, it was kind of like going back to their blues.
Yeah, like those
roots.
Tracks that I played a few shows ago. But the old blues stuff is the stuff that I was liking the best. It just suggested what they did best. But they're really desperately trying to be current, and the current stuff wasn't really.
It was kind of falling flat, really.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was kind of. It was like neither a rock nor a hard place, as to, you know, paraphrase their own, one of their own semi-hits.
It's like soda pop that's gone flat.
Well, speaking of looking back, Keith talks about some of the tours, because the one thing they didn't have to worry about, the albums might, you know, the singles might not have been selling, but boy, the tickets sure were. When they were touring, some of the biggest tours of all time were happening around this time. So the Stones were certainly not worried. If they didn't have a hit single in the top 10 or even in the top 40, it didn't matter, because if they played live, they could sell out anywhere in a matter of minutes. And that was global. Right. That was their appeal. Keith talks about that a little bit here. At the tail end of the Steel Wheels tour, we liberated Prague, or so it felt, one in Stalin's eye. We played a concert there soon after the revolution that ended the communist regime. Tanks roll out, Stones roll in was the headline. It was a great coup by Vaclav Havel, the politician who had taken Czechoslovakia through a bloodless coup only months earlier, a brilliant move. Tanks were going out, and now we're going to have the Stones. We were glad to be a part of it. Havel is perhaps the only head of state who has made or would imagine making a speech about the role that rock music played in political events leading to a revolution in the Eastern Bloc of Europe.
That's pretty cool.
Right. He is the one politician I'm proud to have met. Lovely guy. Nice to hear that. Meanwhile, going through the album, the next track up on the album after Love is Strong was a song called You've Got Me Rocking. It was also tapped to be a hit single, or released as a single, and its fate was even worse. This one didn't even make the top 100. You Got Me Rockin' stalled at number 113.
Whoa.
Here's that track.
I was falling, but you put on the brake. Well done, Ronnie Wood. Good slide work on that one. We're playing tracks from the album Voodoo Lounge for this show. This is part 42 in our series dedicated to the Rolling Stones. What you are listening to is the show American Hit Radio. Howdy and I do this every Wednesday and Friday from 5 until 6 p.m. So I'm glad you're with us. Let's see. Talking about these sessions, Keith tells an interesting story about the next track that I want to play. So again, I love returning to his book because it's great to let him talk about this. Mick and I had mostly learned to live with our disagreements, but diplomacy was still required to drag us together in 1994. Barbados was again the place to see whether we could get on well enough to make another album, and it went well, as it usually did, when we were alone. Soon after recording there, we all decamped to Ronnie's house in Ireland, in County Kildare, to start work on Voodoo Lounge, and all went well, and then one day, we found out that Jerry Lee Lewis was down the road, hiding from the IRS or something.
How convenient.
It's only an hour or two away. So we asked him, do you want to come up and play? But apparently from Jerry's point of view at the time, or the way it got to him, he was going to make a Jerry Lee Lewis album with the Stones backing him. We were just saying, come up and play. It was just like a jam. We're pretty loose. We've got the studio set up. Let's rock and roll. So we did a lot of stuff, a lot of great stuff, too, and it's all there on tape somewhere. Then we were listening to playbacks later on, and Jerry's going, hey, the drummer's a bit slow there. He's starting to pick the band apart. Hey, that guitar is. And I looked at him, and I said, Jerry, we just did a playback. You know what I mean? We ain't cutting. We're just playing. The red mist was falling, and I said, if you want to tear my band apart, your name's Lewis, right? You're from Wales. I said, my name's Richards. We're both Welsh. So I'll look into your little baby blues, and you look into these two black eyes of mine, and if you want to take it outside, let's deal with it. Don't chop my band up. And I left. I just stormed off, and I actually wrote the next song, Sparks Will Fly Out of It, while watching the bonfire outside.
Burn it up in the smoke of a jet. Sparks will fly away.
Rocker from the Stones, Sparks Will Fly, off of the album Voodoo Lounge.
Indeed.
Continuing the story from Keith, though, regarding especially the situation that they're now playing without Bill Wyman, who is the first album that's coming out without him playing on it at all. We didn't tell the world that Bill had left until 1993 when we found a replacement, which took a while, and thank God we found a guy totally sympathetic. In the end, we didn't have to look far. Daryl Jones is very closely related to the Winos, meaning his own band, the Expensive Winos.
Right.
Great friends with Charlie Drayton and Steve Jordan, so he was on the periphery. Daryl, in my estimation, is a giant, beautiful, an all-round man. And, of course, Daryl's playing 5 years with Miles Davis certainly didn't hurt Charlie Watts, who schooled himself on the great jazz drummers. And Daryl melted into the band real quick. I do enjoy playing with Daryl. He's always provoking me. We have tremendous fun on stage. You want to go there? Fine. Let's go a little further. We know Charlie's got it nailed. Let's try it. Let's sling some hash. And Daryl's never let me down. Meanwhile, we're talking a lot about the chart position of this record and how the singles had fared so poorly. This was the 22nd American studio album that they had released, Voodoo Lounge, 22 here in America. As I said, the first without Bill Wyman. But meanwhile, it is also the album won their Grammy Award for Best Rock Album that year and went to number 2 in the United States, double platinum.
Hmm.
Now, it also, though, on the other hand, was the first Rolling Stones album to not produce significant hits in the United States, even with 2 million copies sold. It had 4 hits, though, in the UK. Love is Strong and You Got Me Rocking, which you already heard, an upcoming song called I Go Wild, and this song, we're going to play right now, called Out of Tears.
Oh, from within. Some you lose, some you win. I can dream till I float off your screen. And I just can't pour my heart out to another living thing. I'm a whisper, I'm a shadow, standing up to the same.
The Ballad on the album, one of the hit singles in Europe, although it didn't even chart here in America, called Out of Tears off of the album Voodoo Lounge. Should be noted that the producer on this album is Don Was. He was brought in to co-produce the record with Keith and Mick. Really brought in by Mick, because the whole idea was that he had had a number of hit records and Mick wanted to basically stay contemporary, thought that Don would have a good edge for that.
Right.
So he was brought in and to help with setting this album up, their first album without Bill Wyman. So I think that Mick probably had an awful lot of hopes that the fact that things were really going to shift around a lot for the Stones, moving toward a whole new image, a whole new sound. The thing is, though, the first thing that Don wanted to do is he wanted to basically make the band sound like them old, like their old selves. He was pushing them hard to sound like the reproduce, as he called it, the archetypal Rolling Stones sound.
Right.
And Jagger, in particular, was really dissatisfied with this. And he, although he was not responsible for bringing them in, Mick Jagger was quoted as saying, "There were a lot of things that we wrote for Voodoo Lounge that Don steered us away from, groove songs, African influences, and things like that. And he steered us very clear of all that. And I think that was a mistake." Was his answer to that later on was, it was not that he was anti-groove, just anti-groove without substance in the context of this album. They had a number of great grooves, but it was like, okay, what goes on top of it? Where does it go?
Right.
We've heard that before. I got on the album Black and Blue.
I think that he was right.
I understand his point.
I think Mick is wrong.
Well, I can understand Don. I'm not even a huge fan of Don Was's production, and I sometimes think that you want to give the artists as much rein as possible to be themselves. Nevertheless, in this instance, I think it would have been a great idea to let the Stones be the Stones. Anyway, he goes on to say, "I just felt that it's not what the people were looking for from the Stones. I was looking for a sign that they can get real serious about this, still play better than anybody, and write better than anybody."
Mm-hmm.
Now, Keith's take on it. Nevertheless, Don was rocked off balance very early on by a sudden and apparently terminal row that erupted in the studio, Windmill Lane in Dublin, between Mick and me, out of the blue, despite our apparent peace terms. It came from sheer non-existent communication, the building up of festering rages.
Uh-oh.
It was the culmination of a lot of things, but mostly, I think, the control freak business that I found so wearing to digest and deal with. Ronnie and I had come back into the studio, and Mick was playing some imitation riffs on a brand new Telecaster. It was one of his songs called I Go Wild, and he was strumming, sitting down. I'm told, I said, "There's only two guitar players in this band, and you're not one of them." I probably threw it out as a joke, but it didn't connect to the funny bone for Mick, and he took it the wrong way, and then it got deeper. I just laid into him, and once again, according to eyewitness accounts, we hammered each other about everything from Anita to contracts to betrayals. It was pretty wild, hurling one-liners at each other. "What about this? Well, what about that?" And everyone else ran. The assistants and Ronnie and Daryl and Charlie and everyone all scuttled into the control room.
I don't know if they were listening on a microphone or not, but several people heard the slinging match. Don was, electing himself arbitrator, you know, tried to do a shuttle diplomacy act because we'd both gone to other ends of the building. But you're saying the same thing, one of those, old trick. Don told me he genuinely believed that if one more word was uttered, everybody was going to get on planes and the show would be over forever. What he underestimated was that we'd been conducting this slanging match for 30 years. In the end, after maybe an hour and a half, we hugged and carried on. Here's the song that was actually, that Mick was strumming on the guitar before that thing erupted. Here's I Go Wild.
Exist? Is this what it get? A poison kiss? Well, that's you. I'm dead meat. I'm a raggedy dog dying in the streets. I forgot the sake of a shanty town where gangs and children.
Yet another song that could perhaps be about the sudden outbursts that break out between Mick and Keith.
Oh, yeah.
Funny. Don Was tells an interesting story about their communication around this time. This is Don Was speaking.
Or lack thereof.
Right. Exactly. When we did Voodoo Lounge, Keith and Mick would exchange pleasantries about a football match for maybe 30 seconds, then go to opposite corners of the room, and then they'd play. But the degree of interaction with each other was part of a group thing. Throughout the making of that whole record, I assumed that they were calling each other at 5 in the morning to talk about what was going to happen the next day and all of that. And it was only when we got to the end that I found out that they never talked to each other. The only time either of them called the other guy was, Mick told me, when Keith hit a speed dial wrong at the Sunset Marquee and Mick was staying at a rented house in the hills, and he called Mick and asked for more ice. He thought it was room service. Anyway, we'll leave you with this track. It's the last song off of the album Voodoo Lounge. This is called Mean Disposition. Take care, everybody. We'll be back next week with yet another Stones Park 43. There you go. See you then.